Welcome to Better Read, an experiment by Greg.org to transform art-related texts into handy, entertaining, and informative audio.
This edition of Better Read features Sincerely Yours, a fiercely awesome text from May 1982 by Rosalind Krauss, which was originally published in October magazine. It is performed here by me, Ava, a computer-generated voice from Apple. The text begins with her own introductory note. After its initial publication, the originality of the avant-garde drew an immediate response from Professor Albert Elson, the organizer of the National Gallery of Arts, Rodin rediscovered. In a four-page letter to the editors of October, Elson attacked the essay's discussion of Rodin's relation to the question of originals and originality, dismissing any possibility that the status of these concepts might be problematic. Writing that my text seemed to have ignored the exhibition's catalog, quote, which includes essays by the former director of the Louvre, on an original in sculpture, Dan Rosenfeld's on Rodin's carved sculpture, and my own on the gates of hell, end quote. Elson went on to repeat what he feels should by now be obvious. Jean Chatelain shows that in France, editions of bronzes have been traditionally considered original. One could add that, just as with prints, then and now, bronze editions were, and are originals. To speak of an original Rembrandt print is no different from speaking of an original Rodin bronze, having decided that, for me, originality means unique, one of a kind. Elson was anxious to counter this definition with Rodin's own. Rodin's view of originality lay in his conceptions, Elson insists, such as his interpretation of the story of the burghers of Calais, or his ideas of what a public monument could be, such as his Balzac. In his time, Rodin's acclaim as an original artist did not rest on making one-of-a-kind sculptures. He considered his authorized bronzes and carvings, reproduced by others, as autograph works, because they were his conceptions, carried out to his standards. If a client wanted a totally distinctive marble, he would stipulate to Rodin that the commissioned work must differ in some visible, unalterable way from any subsequent carvings of the same theme. Rodin's public knew well the system of a division of labor that he inherited and relied upon, to be productive and creative. If originality can be rendered entirely unproblematic for us, so can authenticity. Describing Rodin's relation to Jean Lemay, the sculptor's favorite patinor, Elson adds, contrary to Krauss, Rodin had very strong and consistent views on authenticity. He recognized as authentic only those bronze casts he had authorized. All others he condemned as counterfeit. Equally unproblematic, within this context of reproduction, is the question of repetition. Thus, contrary to Krauss, Rodin's contemporaries were aware of his reutilization of the same figure, not only in the gates, but in his freestanding work. In 1900, reviewing Rodin's retrospective and the Gates of Hell, a critic named Jean E. Schmidt wrote about the gates, the same figure, the same group, inverted, modified, accentuated, simplified, combined with others arranged in a shadow, placed in the light, revealed to their author the secrets of sculpture, the mysteries of composition, the beauties of which he had only confused dreamed. Krauss would have us believe that she and not Rilke, who as Rodin's secretary was in the studio daily for 7 months, has recognized the same figure in the three shades, having set the historical record straight by this series of inversions, contrary to Krauss. Elson then attacked two more recent issues. One was my account of the film documenting the casting of the Gates of Hell, which had been scheduled for the exhibition but was not finished in time to be shown within the context of Rodin rediscovered, invalidating my reference to it in the originality of the avant-garde. The other was my position in the essay Julio Gonzalez, This New Art, To Draw in Space, which he saw as failing to condemn the posthumous casting of Julio Gonzalez as unique welded ironworks. Regarding this as an evasion of the very issues I had raised in relation to Rodin, Elson went on to present as my position on Gonzalez, that since the use of found materials by Gonzalez was not metaphoric as in Picasso's work, and what he did with welded iron was a process, many of the issues of direct metal working that would theoretically prohibit translation into bronze are also irrelevant, expressing his indignation over this idea, as well as everything else to be found in the originality of the avant-garde. Elson demands, just what do we call out when a critic invents issues, makes up contradictions, promotes a double standard, and reviews an event that has not yet happened. It was, presumably, this sense of outrage that directed the close of his letter, after a postscript to the readers of October, directing them to the view of experts registered in the Standards for Sculptural Reproduction and Preventive Measures Against Unethical Casting, a view adopted by the Art Museum Directors Association, Artists' Equity, the Art Dealers Association, and the College Art Association. Elson then gave notice to October's editors as follows: C.C., Leo Steinberg, Kirk Varnado, Henry Millen, Arthur Danto. Somewhat puzzled, the editors printed his letter in full, with the exception of that final, censorious, tag, published in October, number 20, spring 1982. Elson's letter was followed by my sincerely yours, Greg.org note. Krauss addressed Elson's issues about the film and Gonzalez in footnotes. These footnotes were, in a lone concession to brevity, not included in this audio rendition. The full text of Krauss's response, along with their original text, The Originality of the Avant-Garde, can be found on the internet and in books. End note. Where to begin? Perhaps contrary-wise, at the end, we could begin with the final paragraph of Professor Elson's discussion of Rodin's perfect collaborator, Henri Lebesgue, published in the catalogue for Rodin Rediscovered, quote, why did Lebesgue accept Benedict's commission to make the huge posthumous version of the defense? Did pride vanquish prudence? Lebesgue's decision is more understandable, if not condonable, when one reads of his problems just after the war in putting his business back on its feet, even with the help of his son, who had been demobilized. Finally, Benedict had the legal, if not ethical, authority as director of the Musée Rodin, and Lebesgue had money coming to him after Rodin's death for other unfinished projects, end quote. These questions and their speculative replies cap the episode with which Elson chooses to close his description of the career of Rodin's favorite reproductor, a man whose letterhead bore the information that he engaged in reducing and enlarging objects of art and industry by a mathematically perfected process and employed a special machine for making these counterparts and additions. Throughout this essay, Professor Elson's most frequently used terms for Lebesgue's marbles is not counterpart but reproduction, a term to which we will return. The episode was a scandal in which Lebesgue was tragically involved, although with the complicity of the first director of the Musée Rodin, who was beneficiary of Rodin's will, had, of course, a legal, if not ethical, authority in this matter. After Rodin's death, Lebesgue began an enlargement of the defense, increasing the original scale of the work fourfold, which is to say, beyond that ever commissioned by Rodin himself. This was done at Benedict's instructions for sale to the Dutch government as a monument to be erected at Verdun. Upon completion, we learn, there was a storm of criticism directed at Benedict for undertaking the posthumous enlargement, and further, tragically for Rodin's perfect collaborator. The Verdun enlargement became part of a 1920 scandal involving fake works, marble carvers who continued to turn out sculptures signed with Rodin's name, and unauthorized bronze casts of the Barbetien foundry. Now the major difference between Lebesgue and the other marble carvers who continue to turn out sculptures signed with Rodin's name seems to be that their fake was illegal and his wasn't, by virtue of the authorization of the artist or his beneficiaries. See General Code of Taxes, Appendix 3, Article 17. In this case, the Musée Rodin, which is by law the sole proper holder of the artist's rights of authorship, and thus the source of legal, if not ethical, authority, the director of the Musée Rodin, no less than Lebesgue, approaches this question of authorship with money on his mind, for the museum's endowment is the right of reproduction, and its income is derived from the continuing flow of originals. The quote, legal if not ethical authority is, indeed, central to the concept of the original edition and its careful buttressing not only by the penal code but also by the general code of taxes. For the law interests itself greatly in the question of the way originality opens directly onto the matter of contracts. As Elson assures us in his letter, Jean Chatelain is very illuminating on the whole problem of the sculptural original, particularly the issue to which he mainly limits himself, that of original editions. The special worth of an original edition, Chatelain writes, does not come from an objective character of its originality. In the etymological meaning of the term, since every edition is in itself an operation of reproducing a model which is really the original, nor does this come about for want of a legal or customary definition. It arises from the agreements made by the edition's author with the buyers. The buyers, what do they have to do with the matter of authorship or the status of the original? Linking as it does the revolutionary upheaval which shattered the traditional workshop system and the advent of an individualistic philosophy, followed by the rise of Romanticism and the development of the art market and speculation, Chatelain's account of the development of the idea of the original edition has everything to do with consumption. The 19th century buyer, he explains, was infected by the notion of originality, by which was understood innovation, creativity, inspiration, and, conflating originality with the condition of the physical original, he desired to possess the object that most directly bore the traces of this spontaneous, unrepeatable process. Because of this new condition of desire, any reproduction of an artist's work made by someone else, no matter what the process might be, is without real artistic value and therefore of an inconsequential price, for it no longer gives direct evidence of the creative impulse. For the compound arts, such as bronze sculpture, which are arts of repetition, this new economy of desire threatened an absolute fall in value and required an immediate response. The original edition was the form of that response, a formula that Chatelain is quick to tell us defies logic and linguistic accuracy, since originality implies uniqueness, while an edition implies diffusion, multiplication, and series. But as in most economic processes, the logic has little to do with semantics or etymological meaning, and is instead a function of supply and demand, of what Chatelain calls systematic rarefaction. Again and again, Chatelain stresses that the original edition is a juridical fiction set up to create what could be called the originality effect. The effectiveness of this formula remains such in the eyes of the public at large that we can see it used to give greater value to editions which, for want of being originals, will at least have the appearance of being so, by being numbered. At first, reading this, we feel that Chatelain is being facetious, or perhaps is writing out of a scarcely veiled cynicism. But this is the effect of extracting pieces of his prose from the full context of his presentation, where his discussion is at pains to explain the reasonableness of the system and thus to account for the drift of his argument as it moves inexorably away from etymological meaning and into the determinations of the marketplace, thus dismissing the possibility of competent authorities to define what is an original edition at a given moment and for a given art, and viewing their indecision as something that only reinforces this feeling of relativism. This former director of the Louvre throws the question into the arena of commerce. Quote, "Once again, as is the usual formula in a liberal rights system, there remains the will of the parties involved. It is up to both sides to define what they mutually agree to. In our field it is quite clear that the bidder, the seller that is to say, eventually the holder of the copyright of a certain work, be he the creating artist or his beneficiaries, he alone is in a position to set the characteristics of an edition about to be undertaken. He decides how many copies are to be made, what the technical characteristics are to be, and which specialists are to be called in. The buyer cannot help but take or leave the conditions thus laid out. The most he can do, aside from simply saying yes or no, is to try to bargain down the price or ask for some special secondary characteristic, in bronze, for example, for a certain type of socle," end quote. The beneficiary is thus truly the holder of the artist's authorship, for he alone, once the artist is dead, is in a position to set the characteristics of an edition, and the buyer, desiring an original, the object of his desire, he must do what he can to bargain down the price. For Chatelain, the wholly commercial slash conventional nature of the original edition, which, in order to stress the oxymoronic quality of the formula, he sometimes changes to original copy, raises logical problems such that interpretation of the relevant legal instruments can often pose difficulties. As an example, he examines a recent decree bearing on the tax code and treating the suppression of frauds in transactions involving works of art. This decree mandates that all reproductions of an original work carry the indelible notation reproduction. Included in this category are casts of casts. Now, the problem, as Chatelain sees it, arises from the fact that the term casts of casts seems to limit itself to casts not made from the original matrix, that is, in the case of bronze sculpture, not made from the original plaster. What that would mean is that any cast made from the original plaster, even after the threshold of the original edition had been reached, in the case of Rodin, 12 casts, would not be a reproduction, but would be part of an edition and in some sense, legal, if not ethical, an original. This possibility does not seem compatible with the principle of systematic rarefaction, and so another reading of casts of casts is imagined by Chatelain. In this interpretation, which he calls more stringent, all casts made once the limit of the original edition is reached, whether from the original plaster or not, would be considered reproductions and would have to be so labeled. Which of these interpretations should we adopt? Technically, only the first interpretation seems to us to be justified since it rests on a criterion which is itself technical. That which is made from the original plaster is a proof, an addition. That which is not made from the original plaster is a reproduction. On the other hand, the overall spirit of the decree of 3 March 1981 is evidently to impose strict limits on the art trade as to the designation of objects. One can therefore think that the second interpretation, because it is restrictive, conforms more than the first to this spirit. The spirit of this decree is to impose limits on the art trade, which seems among other things to mean shoring up that fallible market for the compound arts by the operations of systematic rarefaction. The decrees and codes to which Chatelain refers are of course articles of French law made with particular regard to a French art market that is taken seriously indeed. On this subject no one could suspect Chatelain of being facetious, nor the French government. In October 1981, a tax on wealth passed by the socialist-controlled parliament was to have included privately held works of art. At the 11th hour, however, Mitterrand, apparently convinced of the serious blow that would have thereby been dealt to the art market in France, exempted works of art from the bill. The following day the newspaper Libération carried the headline, Vendez vos yachts, achetez des Picassos. No one here but the most heterodox left is going to joke about a market's production of rarefaction, systematic or otherwise. But Elson, who distinguishes between legal and ethical authority, seems to want the definitions that go beyond this commercial conventional notion of the authenticity of original editions. In his introduction to Rodin Rediscovered, he refers to the American Statement of Standards on the Reproduction of Sculptures, which he also cites at the end of his letter, for a criterion that goes beyond authenticity, namely, desirability. And there he writes that although posthumous casts by the Musée Rodin are unquestionably authentic in the terms of the sculptor's intent, and his grant of the right of reproduction to the state, they are viewed by these standards as less desirable than those made in Rodin's lifetime. This viewing, with its lessening of desire, is Elson's, not mine. Contrary to his notion that I regard the production of posthumous casts through the lens of condemnation, worry, and dismissal, I welcome the opportunity it affords us, who are we, here to experience the conundrum posed by the original, by convention in cases of the compound arts, because, contrary to Elson's reading of my argument, I wish to explore the possibility that this convention is no less operative within the simple arts, thus raising the possibility that all claims to originality are equally conventional / juridical. Contrary to Elson, this is not a worry, but a welcoming theory. With those three contraries, we move into the series of statements made in Elson's letter which often take the form, contrary to Krauss. For example, contrary to Krauss, Rodin had very strong and consistent views on authenticity, or contrary to Krauss, Rodin's contemporaries were aware of his reutilization of the same figure. Indignant at my seeming contrariness, Elson accuses me of inventing issues, making up contradictions, promoting a double standard, and reviewing an event that has not yet happened, all of this adding up to fraud. But what of the contraries to his contraries? What if his disclaimers make false claims about mine? Would that be fraud, or would it be argument of the kind that theory often elicits from disciplinary orthodoxy? Let us begin a contrario. Contrary to Elson, I did not condemn the recent casting of Rodin's Gates of Hell as fake. I specifically called it a legitimate work and a real original. But I also imagined confusion arising in viewers' minds, which would lead them to brand the work as fake or counterfeit. After all, this confusion has, historically, arisen in relation to Rodin's own standard shop practices. Elson himself cites instances of it. There was a storm of criticism directed at Benedict for undertaking the posthumous enlargement. Many people misunderstood the enlarging process and did not realize that for Rodin it was not to be strictly mechanical. There was published criticism that Le Bassé had betrayed Rodin. If this misunderstanding could have arisen in Rodin's day, despite the fact that, as Elson tells us, Rodin's public knew well the system of a division of labor that he inherited and relied upon to be productive and creative, how could it not occur even more insistently now? That it does occur is mentioned over and over by Elson and his collaborators in the catalogue Rodin Rediscovered. They cannot seem to shake off the nag of this uninformed public doubt. In discussing Rodin's carved sculpture, Daniel Rosenfeld describes the corps of workmen that surrounded the master in his studio. Between 1900 and 1910, nearly 50 individuals were involved with the execution of Rodin's marble sculptures. Anne begins his account of the atelier with the sentence, "The multiple marble examples of Eve, 12 or more, raise the question of originality and authenticity in Rodin's carved sculpture." Like Elson, he feels certain that this question is an anachronism and would not have troubled Rodin's contemporaries, but that it does disturb us now is acknowledged, for example, by asides like the issue of their authenticity as products of the artist's hand. So disquieting to some modern critics, by imagining the scene of this kind of disquietude and confusion, in which multiple appellations could be appended to an object, could be, and are, appellations that range across a wide spectrum, counterfeit, legitimate, authentic, desirable, a scene that is repeated not just by some uninformed member of the public but by art historical experts, like Jean Chatelain in his arresting indecision about what to call those unfortunate proofs that have been pulled past the legal limit of the original edition. Are they reproductions? They're not really reproductions. By imagining this scene, in all the intensity of its indecision, I wish to inaugurate a discussion that could not be solved in the confines of a courtroom or even the chambers of the College Art Association or the Art Dealers of America. This is a question of what could be called an irreducible plurality, a condition of multiplicity that will not reduce to the unit one, to the singular or unique, a condition that is inside the very existence of the unique or singular instance, multiplying it. Under this condition, the compound arts are, simply, compound, and no amount of systematic rarefaction will change this. The transfer of the idea from medium to medium in the production of the final original guarantees that inside that ultimate oneness is such a state of fission that the locus of singularity keeps receding from us. Take, for example, the testimony of George Bernard Shaw. Like everyone else, he was conversant with the facts of Rodin's production and the paradox that the sculptor with the inimitable touch was famous for works that he himself had never laid hands on. Elson: no sculptor in history is more famous for having an inimitable touch than Auguste Rodin. Yet big public works like the monument Low Balzac and The Thinker, on which much of Rodin's reputation is based, in fact issued from the hands of Henri Le Bassé. Shaw was also aware that Rodin himself firmly located the original of a work in the clay model. People say that all modern sculpture is done by Italian artisans who mechanically reproduce the sculptor's plaster model in the stone. Rodin himself says so, but Shaw begged to differ on this point. The particular qualities that Rodin gets in his marbles are not in the clay models, Shaw writes, insisting that the magical qualities of Rodin are somehow in the marbles and not in the other materials. He gave me three busts of myself, one in bronze, one in plaster, one in marble. The bronze is me, the plaster is me, but the marble has quite another sort of life. It glows, and light flows over it. It does not look solid, it looks luminous, and this curious glowing and flowing keeps people's fingers off it. The magic is what Shaw prizes, but it was not put there by Rodin, because it was not in Rodin's model. It is, we could say, the product of a collaborative effort between the artist, the artisan, and the physical properties of the material, but even that is too simple. If the compound arts are irreducibly compound, that is because at every moment there is the intervention of choices and of skills, the laying on of hands, but even if there is only one hand, Rodin's from start to finish, there is still the slippage that is inevitable in transfer, the multiplicity inside the choice repertory of the single creator. Working in a compound art, Rodin had choices about how to produce the final versions of his works, both in terms of scale and material. For many years now, critical opinion has been that Rodin's choices with regard to many of his marbles were a betrayal of his art. Dulcified replicas made by hired hands, Leo Steinberg called them in the opening of his extraordinary study of Rodin, by way of meditating on the reasons for the nearly total eclipse of the artist's fame during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Even Ilsen in those days acknowledged that the marbles were a problem. Writing to Steinberg in 1969, he said, "Admittedly, the marbles are not his best. Much of the stone carving is hack work. We know that there has been no editing of his marbles on view in Paris. Would it be an exaggeration to say that inside Rodin there were at least two artists and that one, collaborating with the least exigent tastes of his own time, Shaw's perhaps, betrayed the other? And in that case, would we not speak not only of a divided or compound original, but also of a divided intention? At one end of the scale, the intention determinately to withhold work from finalization and production. At war with the intention at the other end, the intention toward manufacture. Thus, even within the notion of the artist's intention, which Ilsen seems to think is so univocal, contrary to Krauss, Rodin had very strong and consistent views on authenticity. He recognized as authentic only those bronze casts he had authorized. All others he condemned as counterfeit, but neither Rodin's nor Gonzalez's intentions count with Krauss. There may be a multiplicity. In the war that can develop between divided intentions, is there not the possibility of an internal fraudulence, a sense that in doing a certain thing, an artist has betrayed aspects of his own work? Informed taste feels this way about the mammoth concrete blow-ups of little matchbook maquettes that Picasso produced as sculpture during his waning years. This is a kind of fraudulence that is internal to an artist, seeming to be the inescapable result of the fact that an aesthetic idea cannot simply be externalized, as such, from the artist's brain. It, itself a fictitious unity, goes through stages, and at any one of them it can be betrayed by the artist himself, by his intentions, by his very notions of authenticity. It was this kind of internal betrayal that I had in mind when I wrote that Rodin participated in the transformation of his own work into kitsch. Contrary to Ilsen, I did not use this label for the Musée Rodin casts. I had in mind not only the bulk of the marbles, dulcified replicas, hack work, but the kind of output described in Rodin Rediscovered in the section devoted to Rodin and his founders. The following concerns the fate of a marble bust titled Suzon, which was worked by the Brussels firm Compagnie des Bronzes beginning in 1875. Quote, "In 1927, she was still found among the pieces offered by the Compagnie des Bronzes in five sizes, either the original one, 0.3 meters, or four mechanical reductions of 0.26, 0.21, 0.16 and 0.12 meters. These bronzes of diverse formats and also the numerous examples in marble, terracotta, and biscuit, instigated many decorative combinations, such as mounting above clocks, or on fanciful bases, found most often in Belgian and Dutch private collections." End quote. Did Rodin, we wonder, design the clocks, or the fanciful bases? Did he authorize this in limited edition? In 1875? In 1927? At some point did it become counterfeit, this authorization, the warrant of Rodin's intentions with regard to authenticity, his undivided intentions, led in certain cases to unlimited permissiveness? He contracted with bronze editors, writes Ilsen, for unlimited replicas of popular works such as The Kiss, Eternal Spring, and Victor Hugo. Consistent with his peers, Rodin did not usually cast in limited editions, a practice that seems to have been introduced at the turn of the century by art dealers such as Ambroise Vaillard. In other cases, such as the Suzon, it led to the authorized manufacture of objet d'art, sculpture plus clocks, the industrialization of the artisanal experience, the corruption of the aesthetics of handicraft by the processes of mechanical reproduction. The commonly used appellation for this corruption is kitsch. But even where we are not talking about the extremes of mechanical reproduction bearing the authorized patent Rodin, we have ample evidence of Rodin's submission to the internal logic of the reproductive mediums, which is indeed, as Elson tells us, the division of labor. This division, which had led one 19th century writer to ask, is the artist one man or a collection of people, was equally applicable to carving as to casting. Yet, we read in Rodin Rediscovered, bronze casting made supervision more difficult since it was done outside of the artist's studio. During the course of Rodin's career, at least 28 separate foundries were employed in the business of casting his work, making supervision difficult indeed. As one of its contributions to our knowledge of 19th century artistic practice, Rodin Rediscovered provides us with evidence about the degree to which the master acceded to the logic of divided labor necessary to the reproduction of his art. Elson is able to report, to the best of our knowledge, Rodin did not actually participate in the casting and finishing of his bronzes. He left that to specialists who knew his high standards. For more than 15 years, he trusted Jean Lemay to patinate most of his important casts and report on their quality. This report was needed, we learn, because of Rodin's absence from the foundries, particularly after 1900, and thus his ignorance of the state of the casts. Since the castings were sent directly by the founders to Lemay, Rodin, who had not seen them, asked about the quality of the casts, as this letter of 3 September 1903 from Lemay bears witness. I was waiting for the bronzes which Auden sent me to examine the head of Madame Rodin. The cast is not bad, but the chiseling, in my opinion, leaves much to be desired. One can judge this piece, which is very simple, with difficulty. Having so quoted the author of this study of Rodin's casting procedures, and adds, it can be remarked, therefore, that the notion of strict control of the casts and the patinas by Rodin himself needs to be shaded, at least from 1900. What, we wonder, then happened to this head of Madame Rodin, the chiseling of which, in the view of Jean Lemay, left much to be desired? For Rodin, Lemay was one of the specialists who knew his high standards, and Lemay's opinion was that the chiseling left much to be desired. Was the work issued anyway? Is this what is meant by the shading that is needed for the notion of strict control of the casts? Does such shading also need to be applied to the notion of Rodin's standards, Rodin's consistent views, Rodin's intentions? This shading is required because of the extent to which Rodin participated in what I called, in the originality of the avant-garde, the ethos of reproduction. Contrary to Elson, I did not write, to Coeur, that Rodin never supervised or regulated either the finishing or the patination, and in the end, never checked the pieces before they were shipped to the client. I said, much of it, the casting, was done in foundries to which Rodin never went while the production was in progress. He never, etc., a view that is wholly supported by Rodin Rediscovered, and is only rendered false by omitting the qualifying phrase, much of it. Why would Elson wish to misquote? But Elson's contrariness increases as we penetrate more deeply the territory of this ethos of reproduction, which is, we could say, aesthetically trivial with regard to the master's supervision of casts, but formally quite material when we approach Rodin's conceptions, such as his rethinking how to compose a figure or a group. At that point, Rodin's frequent practice of composing by what Leo Steinberg has called multiplication becomes extremely interesting to consider. The plasters, cast from the clay models, which had before Rodin been the formally neutral vehicle of reproduction, became for him a medium of composition. If there can be, must be, one plaster, why not three? And if three, thus the multiple, we could say, became the medium. With the recognition of this absorption of multiples into the core of Rodin's conceptions, this representation of the very means of reproduction, we begin to cross the bridge that both separates and links the material, legal, etymological original, Elson's one-of-a-kind, and the imaginative, conceptual original, which is to say, originality, a function of the powers of imagination. But we are only beginning to cross the bridge, and still within its structure, we have a view of both sides. We can see the transition as the material aspects shade into the conceptual. We can spot the sublime creative confusion engendered by Rodin's move to heighten the representation of movement, the breathlessness of each unique, fleeting moment of temporality, through the stutter of mechanical replicas, lined up side by side. Contrary to Elson, I never claimed priority in the observation that the three shades presents us with the same figure in triplicate. My reference to Leo Steinberg's prior discussion of this phenomenon throughout Rodin's work makes this obvious, but the recognition of this aspect that Professor Els invests in Rodin's contemporaries is not the same thing as interpretation, and thus the question of what this triplication might mean, with all the variety of its possible answers and possible denials, remains. Its experience in 1900 by, quote, a critic named Jean E. Schmidt, did he earn his obscurity? We wonder, is entirely hostage to the 19th century view that artistic greatness is the function of an ecstatic imagination, the same figure, the same group, inverted, modified, accentuated, simplified, combined with others, arranged in a shadow, placed in the light, revealed to their author the secrets of sculpture, the mysteries of composition, the beauties of which he had only confusedly dreamed, in its effort to rescue Rodin's art from the enthusiasm of sentiment, and make it available to the rather sterner assessment of modernism, Leo Steinberg's reading of this manipulation of sameness regards the phenomenon of multiplication through the lens of process. The revelation of process works to expose the means of representation. In formalist terms, it bears the device. It is the intentional, shocking construction of a surface that will report not on the secrets of sculpture, but on the banalities of making. In addition to sheer multiplication, there is the whole panoply of casting error courted and magnified by Rodin, as there is also the phenomenon of modeling strategies, like the little clay pellets added to a given plane to further the buildup of the form, left in their most primitive state to be recorded by the final cast. This bearing of the device is not discussed by Rilke, nor by Jean E. Schmidt. It was, it would seem, not visible to them. Are we then forced to abandon it, as an illegitimate reading, surpassing as it does the critical powers of the viewer of Rodin's own time? Are we thereby compelled to say that because he didn't, or couldn't articulate this view of his art, Rodin didn't intend these accidents that support Steinberg's reading? But the accidents are too profuse and too stunning in their seeming perversity for us to dismiss them as unintentional. A view of intentionality entirely limited to contemporary documents is, it would seem, an unusable view, too rigid, too narrow to support the evidence of the work. It is also a curiously naive view, insisting that all intentions must be conscious causes. If the originality of the avant-garde adds my reading to Steinberg's, this is because the concept of multiples explored there is not the same as the notion of multiplication, though my conception is not intended to refute his. Multiplication, as I have said, is a feature of a more general revelation of the particularity of the artist's means. It is this particularity that is welcome to modernist sensibilities and restores an experience of uniqueness to the work. In this experience of uniqueness is married the surprise, the originality, of the strategy by which the material vehicle of the work is manifested in the sensuous immediacy of that revealed physicality. But the notion of multiples does not resolve itself into this revised, modernist experience of the absolute uniqueness of the object. As I said above, it is grounded on the perception of an irreducible plurality, the condition of the multiple without an original. Multiplication, as Steinberg develops it, opens our perception onto process, or production. Multiples are a function, rather, of reproduction. Rodin's work was continually moving between production, the tiny clay pellets of the master's modeling, and reproduction, the authorized Rodin. If Rodin was able, consciously, unconsciously, to manifest the processes of production within his work, why not equally the terms of reproduction? But these are terms that are deeply disturbing to the art historian because he cannot imagine a situation of irreducible plurality, a multiple without an original. It is to this failure of imagination that the story of the Gates of Hell addresses itself. It is the story that Elson's letter is so anxious to deny, even though it is, in fact, told by Elson in the pages of Rodin Rediscovered. For the huge exhibition of Rodin's work in the summer of 1900, the Gates of Hell were shipped dismantled, their montage to take place at the time of installation. But this reassembly did not take place, and so, as Judith Claddell reported, the day of the opening arrived before the master had been able to have placed on the front and on the panels of his monument the hundreds of great and small figures destined for their ornamentation. And then, the gates were never again reassembled under Rodin's supervision, not during the time of the exhibition nor afterward at Meudon. Cladel believed that the work was not reassembled in 1900 because he had seen it too much during the 20 years in which it had been before his eyes. He was tired of it, weary of it, but that this weariness should have extended for the next 16 years does bear some explanation. One of these explanations has been that Rodin never considered the work to be finished, and it was for this reason that visitors to Rodin's studio had to deal with the gates in their disassembled state. Elson's explanation is different. Rodin's refusal to reassemble his portal after June 1, 1900, he suggests, may have resulted from the view that, as it was, the work had a greater breadth and unity of form. If this is so, then Rodin's undivided intention bifurcates, pointing in at least two directions, one of them, the gates as we now know it, the other, the idealized unity wrested from a heaving, nearly barren ground. Before his death, Rodin presumably agreed to a new cast of the gates that would be placed in the Rodin Museum in Paris. This second, full plaster model was not personally assembled or directed by Rodin before his death in November 1917. It was done under the direction of the museum's ambitious first director, Léonce Benedict. Elson continues, "We know that from some time in 1916 until his death, Rodin was physically incapable of doing even the smallest amount of work with his hands, due probably to a stroke, but what Rodin could do with his hands is not really the issue, for the likelihood is that the work of reassembly was not even conducted in his presence." Benedict insisted that the montage was done under the master's direction, but from what we know of Rodin's health, this is extremely doubtful. If the montage was done at the Depot de Marbre, it is even more doubtful, as Rodin was very much restricted to Meudon the last year of his life. Elson's scholarship leads him to the conclusion that Benedict undertook this assemblage on his own initiative and that he even violated certain of Rodin's own ideas in the course of the reconstruction. Since Elson's letter insists that the posthumous casts, all of which were made from mold taken from this new Musée Rodin plaster, are of Rodin's realization of the gates of hell in 1900, we can only assume that in his eagerness to argue for the authorized original object of Rodin's undivided intentions, he had forgotten his own description of the liberties taken in this presumably authorized final cast. Elson's presentation of these liberties is worth quoting in full, quote, "Surely, if Rodin had initiated the final assembly, his first director would have so indicated to the world in 1917, rather than in 1921. Benedict took a large number of initiatives without Rodin's knowledge and consent, and, ethics aside, he seems to have had the legal authority to do so. Disturbing evidence of Benedict's meddling with Rodin's arrangement of the gates of hell is given by Judith Cladel when, writing with bitterness during the years 1933 to 1936 about the last weeks of Rodin's life, and the insensitive removal of the artist's sculpture from Meudon to Paris, some of Rodin's scandalized assistants who cast his plasters made it known to me that, charged with the reassembly of the gates of hell, they received orders to place certain figures in a different arrangement than that which the artist wanted, because that would be better, or because the figure of a woman representing a spring, une source, must not have the head below, the sense of the cube, la raison cubique, is the mistress of things, and not appearances," Rodin used to say. But does a shockingly brusque functionary have the time to meditate on such an axiom? Rodin, Salvi, Glorias, A. Ancon New, page 397. Cladel's clear accusation is that Rodin no longer had any say in what happened to his portal, and that Benedict was taking uncalled for and insensitive liberties with its reconstruction. La raison cubique refers to Rodin's view that one should imagine a well-made sculpture as existing within a cube, end quote. The uncalled for and insensitive liberties taken by this shockingly brusque functionary. Is this what Elson means by ambitious? Create the high probability that the 1917 plaster, the matrix from which all the bronze casts of the gates have been taken, differs in aesthetically material ways from the 1900 plaster. Further, as Elson himself records, after 1900 Rodin's own relationship to the gates had become sufficiently complex that he refused to have them reassembled, preferring, perhaps, the greater breadth and unity of form of the Maquiladores, and may or may not have authorized Benedict's actions in 1917. It is this richly multiplex set of doubts raised by the history of the Gates that makes the work so perfect an example, on both the technical and conceptual level, of multiples without an original. As we try to move from the plurality of the casts to the unity of the model, we find this unity, this original, splintering, compounding, and the simple, as distinct from the compound, arts, what of them? Jean Chatelain notes the feeling of relativism excited by the compound arts relation to the notion of the original. This is not the case, he seems to argue, with the simple arts, those with the most immediate, direct relationship between conception and visual mark. But we have reason to wonder whether this simplicity with its accompanying notions of immediacy and directness is not, itself, a product of that very same shift and desire that made the original edition necessary. For just as the compound arts, sculpture, tapestries, marquetry, porcelain, illustrated books, etc., are the functions of workshops and the collaborative results of many skills and many hands, painting is also the product of workshops. The large decorative cycles demanded by patrons in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries could not be accomplished in any other way. The great studios, of which Rubens is only the most well-published example, necessitated an experience of the compound in the carrying out of the work. Art history, a discipline which is an intellectual partner of those newly conceived forces of desire that Jean Chatelain sees rising in the 19th century, art history is committed to the marks of simplicity, to the establishment of the autograph work, and to the sorting out of hands. The existence of the shop can be admitted in the study of painting only as long as the shop itself can be analyzed to produce its elementary components, among them the indisputably autographic work of the master. The finding and constituting of this work will in fact be the task of the art historian, for his empirical unity is this unity, which he takes to be irreducibly simple or singular, of the master's mark. Thus, for example, the analysis of the Ghent altarpiece has often turned on the problem of locating the autographic presence of each of its masters, since it was known that both Hubert and Jan van Eyck had been responsible for its making. Even Panofsky understood that his task as art historian would be, given this dual authorship, the sorting out of hands. Two linked assumptions operate within this notion of the scholarly task. The first is that the painting is a physical simple, and thus is ideally made by one hand. If it is known in a given case to be the work of more than one author, then it can be somehow analyzed into a set of simples. For this reason, the sorting of hands. The second is that as a simple, a painting is what would normally function within a claim to authorship. Authorship is part of the grammar of executing a painting as it is not in, say, executing marquetry. It is in relationship to its seeming naturalness, as an object of the claim to authorship, and thus its greater insistency with regard to the experience of authenticity, that painting is taken to be a unitary object, a simple. As such, it has clear boundaries. It is everything that is inside the frame. The frame, on the other hand, is a function of the decorative or compound arts. The frame is what both links and separates the painting from the complex decorative/architectural system that formed its original context. But for the art historian there is no confusion between painting and frame. Thus, when Lottie Brand Philip undertook to reorient the analytical task with regard to the Ghent altarpiece, the resistance was intense. Her argument was that Hubert van Eyck was an author of the altarpiece, only not of its painted surfaces, but rather of its frame. The idea that authorship might displace itself outward to the frame does terrible things to the system of positivist relationships out of which the art historian works, because authorship would then be made to flow from the bounded pictorial image into that great sea of anonymous artisanal practice that formed the shop systems of the arts. Authorship, with all its decorum and priorities, would collapse under this weight. Authorship assumes that paintings have an absolute firstness in the hierarchy of the arts, and that their frames, which are adjuncts after all, must follow after, being made to fit. But it is perfectly possible to imagine a case where the frame comes first, and the painted panel, like so much decorative filler, comes afterward. Tailored to the measure of the more opulent, resplendent frame, this situation, with all its implication for a collapse of the notions of a hierarchy natural to the arts, is the news that is being delivered to art history with increasing frequency. It is the situation that Creighton Gilbert, for example, has discovered in the relation between panel painters and the carvers of frames and early Renaissance practice in Italy. The notion of the painting as a function of the frame, and not the reverse, tends to shift our focus from being exclusively, singularly, riveted on the interior field. Our focus must begin to dilate, to spread, as the boundary between inside, painting, and outside, frame, begins to blur and to break down. Room is made for the possibility of experiencing the degree to which painting as simple is a constructed category, constructed on the basis of desire, not unlike the original edition. Just as we can also catch ourselves in the act of constructing frames in order illicitly to excise an image from the non-simple context of the obviously compound arts, so as to assert it as pictorial, unitary, framed. A common enough example of this is to be found in the museum displays of ancient seal rings, where photographic enlargements of the impressions made by the seals allow the imagery and forms of the carving to be seen. But by their very transformation of the signet into a framed, enlarged, two-dimensional image, the photographs pictorialize the object, endowing it with a different kind of presence, investing it with an experience of singularity. Photography used to transform the decorative object into a picture, and thus to raise its status, occurs with increasing frequency in museums. In the exhibition, The Search for Alexander, mounted by the National Gallery in Washington, for example, one of the major objects was a bronze crater from Derveni, a vessel over 35 inches high, with continuous reliefs of extraordinary quality. Set freestanding within a vitrine in the gallery, the crater was perfectly visible from all sides. Yet the designers of the exhibition felt the need to supplement this object with photographic enlargements of some of its narrative components, fragmenting and composing aspects of the decorative object into pictures. It would seem that the only experience that could correspond to our sense of the object's value, from the point of view of its antiquity and rarity, would be an adaptation of it to fit the aesthetic measure of singularity, which means to reconstrue it in terms of the frame. Within the exhibition, the Derveni crater existed twice, once as a decorative object, and once as a series of pictures, larger than itself, framed and mounted on a wall. This institution of the frame is a function of what could be called the institution of the frame. It is an act of excision that simultaneously establishes and reaffirms given conceptual unities, the unity of formal coherence, the unity of the enframed simple, the unity of the artist's personal style, his oeuvre, his intentions, and these turn out to be the very unities on which the institution of art, and its history, presently depends. As research uncovers more and more information about given practices, this new data is poured through the slots of old categories to fill the unitary spaces. Thus Elson can begin his introduction to Rodin Rediscovered by declaring, "Our aim in preparing this catalog was to present the latest Rodin research." He never imagines that this latest research might in fact provide the ammunition to place those unities, through which research was formerly collated and valued, under fire. All of the information needed to open Rodin's gates of hell to the experience of the multiple without an original is to be found in Rodin Rediscovered. Elson and his fellow researchers provide it. Contrary to Elson, I no more consider myself to be inventing issues, in the sense of originating them, than to be laying claim to a first view of Rodin's use of triplication. These issues, through which the physical original along with the originary act are rendered a problem for history and criticism, and not the goal of their endeavors, have long been the shared concern of scholars and writers in many fields and countries. At the end of the 1960s, Michel Foucault described this collective inquiry, quote, "What one is seeing, then, is the emergence of a whole field of questions, some of which are already familiar, by which this new form of history is trying to develop its own theory. How is one to specify the different concepts that enable us to conceive of discontinuity, threshold, rupture, break, mutation, transformation? By what criteria is one to isolate the unities with which one is dealing? What is a science? What is an oeuvre? What is a theory? What is a concept? What is a text? How is one to diversify the levels at which one may place oneself, each of which possesses its own divisions and form of analysis? What is the legitimate level of formalization? What is that of interpretation, of structural analysis, of attributions of causality, end quote? But contemporary practice in the visual arts provides its critics with a special perspective on the problematic of one of these unities, which is that of a work, an aesthetic original. For we can watch the frantic attempts to reconstitute this unity even as all the activities of late modernism dramatize its dissolution as a mode of experience, as the work of a depleted modernism becomes increasingly porous, admitting more and more citations from past art to enter the field of the image. This open terrain of eclecticism must be re-contained or reunified in some way if it is to retain its art value, and thus its market value. Two ways are employed at present. First, frames. The work of Julian Schnabel, for example, resurrects the heavy, ornamented wooden frame of the old master painting in order to reconstitute the interiority of the objects he makes, to shore up their identity as symbols, an identity that would otherwise be contested by his recourse to imitation and pastiche. Second, the authorial mark of emotion, expressionism, psychological depth, sincerity. Feeling is the mark of the pictorial original. Much recent painting is both executed and received as though there were nothing problematic about the formulas of feeling and their continual reuse. The critical term expressionism is applied to these pictorial objects of manufacture with as little thought for its appropriateness as if it were to be appended to any of those conventions that operate the terms of polite address, like this one with which I will close my reply to Professor Elson. Sincerely yours.